I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. And this is The Exchange. Today, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. And here are some of the voices from this week's top stories.
Now I feel that it's time for me to take a step back and catch my breath, and to give my family a break, too.
This bill is about the possible. It is about what we can pass today and to get some revenue into our highway fund. That's the goal before us here today.
We and the Rockingham County Commissioners have filed a motion for an expedited hearing on the petition to remove Attorney Reams as county attorney.
The law is that you can't remove a public official for conduct that occurred in prior terms, only for instances of misconduct that occurred during current term.
He addressed the judge, he apologized, he admitted what he did was wrong. At times he got very emotional, he had to stop for several seconds, which seemed longer because everyone's just listening and he's trying to compose himself, especially when he said he betrayed his fellow priests and the faithful.
From the top, that was New Hampshire House Speaker Terry Norelli announcing that she will not be seeking re-election. Democratic Representative David Campbell of Nashua, the lead sponsor of a 4-cent gas tax bill. The bill passed the House and now heads to the governor's desk. Then, two voices in the ongoing story of suspended Rockingham County Attorney Jim Reams. First was Deputy Attorney General Ann Rice, followed by Michael Ramsdell, the attorney for Reams. And finally, Union Leader reporter Mark Hayward, who covered the sentencing of Father Edward Arsenault, former Chancellor of the Manchester Diocese. Arsenault was sentenced to 4 years in prison on Wednesday. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today on The Exchange. Let us hear from you as we examine these and other headlines, including the push for legislation to fight housing discrimination. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477, send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And our guests for the Roundup this week, with me in studio are Kevin Landrigan, senior political reporter for the Nashua Telegraph. Kevin, good to have you back with us this morning.
Dean, great to be with you.
And Norma Love, senior statehouse reporter for the Associated Press. Norma, always good to have you with us.
Good morning, Dean.
And joining us by phone this morning is Joanne McKenzie, New Hampshire editor for the Eagle Tribune and editor of the Derry News. Joanne, welcome back to the Roundup.
Hi, thanks, Dean. Good morning, everyone.
Well, folks, a lot going on this week as usual. Let's start right off the top with the announcement by House Speaker Terry Norelli. Kevin, a bit of a surprise here. What can you tell us?
Actually, it's one of the worst kept secrets in Concord. For a number of months, there was a belief that Terry Norelli was going to choose this to be the time she would exit elective politics after 18 years in the House of Representatives. It's really instructive to look back and think about, it's really hard to believe, frankly, that this very soft-spoken, Winnicott math teacher, vertically challenged, would come and be one of the most accomplished House leaders in recent times. Terry Norelli's story is a fascinating story of triumph, tragedy, and redemption. Triumph in 2006, Democrats take over control of legislature for the first time in almost 85 years. The triumph continues when, historically, in 2008, they keep the majority. Democrats have never done that in state history. The tragedy comes then, which is Democrats, having kept the control, went too far. They adopted the very unpopular LLC tax, the tax on campgrounds. They increased spending by over 10%. They proposed to ban helium balloons. The voters reacted in 2010 with a historic tsunami for Republicans, throwing Terry Norelli out on her ear, and the Democrats with only a third minority in the entire legislature. The redemption comes in 2012. She leads the Democrats on a very aggressive campaign against then-House Speaker Bill O'Brien, a very successful attack machine that threw out O'Brien, reinstalled Terry Norelli. She'll be remembered for promoting transparency, trying to produce a more civil tone in the legislature, and trying to get people to start liking one another again in the House. Things like having them all sit together and ending almost a half century of the House being divided in seating by party. She said, I'm done with that these last 2 years. She mixed them all together, and I think it helped.
A little collegiality goes a long way. Norma, could you give our listeners a sense of what the leadership succession in the Democratic Party might be as a result of this?
Well, we've already heard that a couple of people that might have been mentioned are out. One is David Campbell, representative who led the fight for the gas tax, who also got involved in a problem down in Nashua with ducks. Gary Richardson from Hopkinton is going to become a snowbird, we hear, although he hasn't formally announced it. And he was another leader in her team. The one person that certainly has stepped up immediately is Steve Shurtleff of Concord. He's been a calming voice when they've needed one.
Current majority leader.
He's been a calming voice when they've had someone come up to the podium to give what they call a PI or a parliamentary inquiry to kind of set the stage for a vote. And I think Steve probably has got the inside track, but there will be other people. And, of course, it all depends on whether the Democrats retain the majority in the House, which Norelli said she would work for.
My guess is there'll be, regardless of whether or not they keep the majority, there certainly will be kind of a leadership, structuring after the November election. Joanne, can we read anything at all into this about Democratic fortunes in November? Some Republicans have suggested that this is a foreshadowing of big Democratic losses at the midterm, or do you think it's just not relevant?
I think the Republicans would like us to think it is relevant. I'm not sure. I think Terry Norelli herself tweeted last week that, yeah, the GOP would like to think that I'm worried that this is going to be a shift. So I'm not sure. I think we ought to also note that Terry is only the second woman to be Speaker of the New Hampshire House, the first being actually Republican Donna Sitek from Salem. And I think, you know, I agree that she's restored some civility to the House. I think she also shepherded some major bills through civil unions, then gay marriage, expanded Medicaid. She's been a good tempering presence in the House, and I'm sure she's going to be missed regardless of who replaces her.
So certainly an identifiable legacy for her. Also this week, we had the gas tax finally approved. This is a 4-cent increase in the state's gas tax, now goes to the governor. Joanne, can we start with you? What are the specific provisions of this legislation? What are we looking at with this gas tax?
Well, the biggest thing, and of course, our Gary Senator Jim Rausch was the sponsor of SB 367. The biggest piece down here, and I think statewide, is that 42% of this estimated $33 million in annual additional revenue is going to be dedicated to the completion of the I-93 project. That's, you know, the 20-mile project stretching from the Mass border all the way to New Hampshire to expand that 4-lane highway into a 6/8-lane highway. And that's something that people in this area and the business community, commuters, really want to see happen. Anybody who travels that highway knows what a bottleneck it can be on busy weekends. So this will fund bond payments for the northern stretch of that project, which is the final stretch from Exit 3 North to Manchester. And Bill Boynton of the New Hampshire Department of Transportation told me yesterday, without this passage, they simply didn't have funding and couldn't have put that section of the project out to bid. But beyond the I-93 project, it means doubling the amount of money in the state aid bridge program, which municipalities really count on. That's an 80% state funding with a 20% local match. So doubling that amount means more local bridges will be able to be replaced or repaired. It also means that the state itself, beyond I-93, is going to be able to fund projects that it has had to slide down the priority list due to lack of funding. That money will be split among the six DOT districts statewide for, again, highway and resurfacing and repair. So it's going to mean a lot of construction throughout the Granite State as a result.
And Kevin, any political fallout at all for Governor Hassan or any of the legislators who supported this, or do you think people are just kind of resigned to the need to raise more revenue for roads and bridges?
Well, certainly a good question, Dean. I mean, you'll remember former Governor John Lynch threatened to veto a gas tax increase throughout his term, very popular Democrat, and of course Maggie Hassan wants to continue that legacy in this election. The Republicans are coming hard at Governor Hassan over saying she would sign this bill. Republican candidate Walt Habenstein instead is calling on Governor Hassan to veto this bill. The I-93 project is very popular. And I think there is broad recognition out there. I'd love to hear from callers about this, that the condition of our roads aren't what they used to be. We used to lead the nation in terms of the condition of our roads in all national surveys. Now we're in the bottom 10 states in the country with some of the worst, particularly secondary roads and bridges. And that's where that money for those municipal six districts that Joanne talked about is so critical.
And Norma, does this set the table for subsequent increases, or did you think this was so difficult that it's not likely to come up again for a while?
I think there's a feeling that this is probably going to be it for a while. I want to point out that this was one of two bills that was part of a compromise between the House and the Senate. This was a Senate bill, and the House had the 10-year highway plan, and in that plan they put another $50 million to bond for the I-93 project and money for the Sarah Long Bridge. And those are two critically important projects.
Coming up, we've got to take a brief break, but coming up, we'll talk about the push for paycheck equity legislation in the Granite State and the downgrading of New Hampshire's credit outlook. Is the state economy headed in the wrong direction? Let us know and keep it right here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. You can make sure your membership gift to NHPR goes as far as it can with our corporate match program. Many businesses around the state match your employees' donations to NHPR. You can essentially double the impact of your membership gift. Find out if your company participates at nhpr.org. More of the New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. It's the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank. Banking solutions customized to your business. Information available at centrixbank.com. From Life Safety Fire Protection, installing and servicing fire sprinkler systems throughout New England since 1989, from their home in Dublin to their newest office in Portsmouth, lifesafetyfire.com. And University of New Hampshire in Manchester accepting applications for fall 2014. More information online at manchester.unh.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Twitter, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. My guests today in studio, I have Norma Love, State House reporter for the Associated Press, and Kevin Landrigan, political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. On the phone joining us is Joanne McKenzie, New Hampshire editor for the Eagle Tribune. Folks, let's pick up where we left off, talking about a little bit more State House news. There was a hearing this week on housing discrimination that would prohibit landlords from rejecting tenants who receive federal housing subsidies or who are victims of domestic violence. Tell us a little bit of violence. Tell us a little bit about this hearing.
Well, I think it would be the sole reason. And the concerns are that there aren't enough places, safe places for women to go, for families to go. And that obviously it's a subsidy, but with the federal subsidy comes some requirements. And that includes things like keeping your buildings up to code, making certain kinds of repairs. So it's a it depends on which side you're on. You want the lease and you want to give someone this Section 8 help with your rent, but the landlord has to agree to certain things. And if the housing market goes down, then the subsidy goes down, but your rent may not go down. So that's one issue. A lot of landlords came out and testified that they didn't want to have to be forced to choose between people based solely on this or on whether it was a domestic violence situation. And concerns were raised about, what if I have families in my building and someone's being stalked? Do I want to have that introduced into a building that otherwise might be safe? So someone suggested, well, perhaps the way out of that would be to limit it to only people who have active restraining orders against someone who's an abuser or a stalker. And then small landlords were another issue. What if I'm a very small landlord and I'm put into this position? And New Hampshire's legislature has generally exempted small landlords from these kinds of requirements, and an amendment was proposed. It's not clear where this is going to go because there's points on both sides. You have people who want safe housing, and you have landlords who don't want to be the ones who are put into the position of having to, in a sense, handle tricky situations or potentially violent situations.
Mm-hmm. And Kevin, we heard landlords say repeatedly that it's not about the tenants, it's about this federal voucher program that is problematic, that this is a function of sort of the requirements of the program, not the nature of the individuals who are seeking apartments. I mean, what's your sense of how this is going to play out?
That's right, Dean. That's why some of the landlords even said, hey, look, change this. Take the federal Section 8 language out and change it to we can't discriminate against low-income people who are the sources of these rental subsidies. This bill's in real trouble in the Senate. The landlords are a very powerful grassroots lobby that have a lot of political strength, and particularly in the much smaller Senate. So I think this bill's in real trouble unless it gets written drastically, and that may not even save it.
Kevin, let me come back to you. One more issue that got a lot of attention this week. Standard & Poor's downgraded the state's outlook on general obligations and state-guaranteed bonds, so basically a credit downgrade from stable to negative. Now, it didn't lower the bond rating from AAA, but this caught some people by surprise. Republicans were quick to point out that this is a symptom of the state's economy. What precipitated this downgrade? I know it ties into something we've talked about before on the roundup.
It does, Dean. It really was all about the April 11th decision in the Hillsborough County Superior Court, which ruled that the Medicaid enhancement tax we've been relying on since 1991 is unconstitutionally fair. You're taxing hospitals for health care services when you're not taxing other health care providers that may be providing that same service. A physical therapy office doesn't pay the tax, but a hospital that provides physical therapy does pay the tax on that service. As you point out, this isn't technically a downgrade. Standard & Poor's is a Wall Street investment analyst company, one of the three most respected in the world, not just the country. So when they talk, people listen, like E.F. Hutton. The problem here is this was a bucket of cold water to the political leadership. Basically, when they downgrade your bonds, when they lower the rate on your bonds, Standard & Poor's is saying to the investors, don't buy those bonds. When they change the outlook from stable to negative, as they have, Standard & Poor's is saying to the political leadership, get your act together. You just lost a decision in court that could lose as much as $140 million, and you've only got $9 million in your piggy bank.
Joanne, as a practical matter, is this worrisome for New Hampshire?
Oh, it ought to be worrisome for New Hampshire, absolutely. As Kevin pointed out, I think the core of this is the Medicaid enhancement tax, which is going to cost the state, could be upward of $200 million in its budget. That's a hefty, like 10-12% of its general fund revenue. And it's also the Standard & Poor's announcement has led to lots of finger pointing in Concord. The Republicans are blaming poor leadership on the part of Governor Maggie Hassan. The Democrats are looking back to the session of 2011-2012 when the Republicans dominated and they say, you know, short-term thinking, long-term damage in the budget that came out of that session. So, yes, it is a cause for great concern. And I think we also ought to note that the underfunding of pension levels is a big concern in this, too, not only the small rainy day fund.
Norma, your thoughts?
Well, this goes back a long time. I mean, we're not looking at something sudden. When we first had this tax, it was done as a, here, you give me a dollar, I'll run to the federal government, get a match, and you can have your dollar back. And a lot of states did it. After a while, the government, federal government said, hey, this is costing us a lot of money, and they started cracking down. And I think it was 2-3 years ago, they said, start making it a formula that really does show you're taking in money according to how you're paying out on hospitals or others who are treating more Medicaid people, and they're not getting compensated for it. So we call it the uncompensated care. And what happened in the O'Brien years as House Speaker and the last session, we were in a, we will not raise taxes, no taxes. So what they did was they cut university funding and they cut the hospital money. This was on top of this formula change. So hospitals suddenly said, hey, we really care about the fact that you're taxing these revenues. Before, it wasn't such a big deal. You can tax this or that. Now we started looking at the revenues and what went into them. So they sued, and this is where we are now. And in the next couple of weeks, I suspect that there will be a patch made on whatever, a patch, a fix, something, to get us to next session where the Republicans and Democrats alike, I think, would like to do some major changes in health care in New Hampshire, particularly in Medicaid.
So, Kevin, we've had the scenario floated now that if it turns out that the state Supreme Court declares this tax unconstitutional, we could be looking at a huge budget hole, I think $185 million or something like that. What do you think will happen? How will the next governor, either Governor Hassan or someone else, deal with this?
Well, as Norma indicated, I think there's growing bipartisan support to create a patch for this flat tire. Now, as we know, I'm a veteran of some flat tires here, and in the interest of full disclosure, you put a patch on it, the car will run, but it may not pass the next inspection. And that's the problem for the next governor and the next legislature. This patch probably is not going to fill this entire hole. And the next governor and legislature are going to have to look at how we fund health care delivery in New Hampshire in its totality. And with the expansion of Medicaid, we have some changes that could occur, as Norma alluded to. People who support expansion of Medicaid insist that it will lead to a reduction in uncompensated care. That means less payments to the hospitals from the state. It was $56 million last year. So There are other things going on in the system that could potentially reduce the size of this hole, but it's a massive problem, and it's going to be the top priority for the next governor.
Joanne, any hunches on how you think this is going to play out?
Not a clue.
That's okay. We'll all stay tuned and see how this plays out, particularly that court decision. I just want to remind our listeners, it's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can call in and join us, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Folks, I want to turn now to the Paycheck Equity Bill. The House this week gave preliminary approval to a bill that would make it easier for employees to discuss their salary. It would strengthen non-retaliation laws to protect employees who claim inequities. This is something I had never really thought about, that you shouldn't discuss you can't discuss your salary with your coworkers. Norma, what's the outlook or rationale for this particular piece of legislation?
Well, this bill that passed the House preliminarily this week was sent to a second committee to look at, I believe, the fine structure. Both chambers have passed bills, similar bills, so I believe something will come out of it. And I think the sense is that, as a matter of fairness, I shouldn't tell Dean or Kevin or Joanne that you can't talk about what you're making for a living and discuss it with your coworkers. The other side is saying, no, that will cause disharmony in the workplace if people know what you're making. And the idea is, certainly the Democrats feel, is to make it easier for women to discover they're making less than a male who's doing the exact same job and lobby for or file a claim that you're being discriminated against. And I think that's the objection by those who feel employers might have a tough time. Now, you can pay based on education or based on performance, seniority, those kinds of things. You can pay differently. You just have to have a reason.
And I think the figure we often hear is something like 70 women make 77 cents on the dollar compared to men, something like that. Kevin, my intuition tells me that this is going to really kind of be folded into the 2014 and 2016 campaigns. How might this be used as kind of a lever by the Democrats?
No question, Dean. And there's a belief certainly among Republican legislators in both the House and the Senate that this is a political agenda, that Barack Obama won two presidential elections by getting a lion's share of women's voters and by identifying issues, wedge issues, that appeal to women. That's how they saw this. Now, Senate Republicans were smart. They said, if you can't beat them, don't fight them, which is – that's why – the pay equity bill passed the state Senate 24-0. In the House Republicans, many of them took the bait and gave up some sound bites that we may hear in this election. One legislator referring to the fact, well, men are more motivated by money than women are. That's why they're paid more. Men work in more dangerous jobs than women. That's why they're paid more. Instead, their mantra should have been, New Hampshire has had a wage discrimination law since 1947, 18 years before the federal government had one. And they should have said, show me the cases, the widespread cases of women being discriminated against in the workplace. There isn't a problem here. That should have been their argument. Instead, they made a lot of intemperate statements that, like I said, are going to come back to haunt them.
Yeah, my sense is that this is going to be a political issue for some time to come. Right, let's turn now to some legal news this week. And Joanne, I'll start with you. There's some more news this week in the ongoing saga of Rockingham County Attorney Jim Reams. The State Attorney General Joseph Foster asked a judge to expedite a hearing on removing him from office. We just learned yesterday that the state Supreme Court ruled that Reams can return to work during the state's appeal. Give us a little bit of an update or on where we are now and how this is going to play out.
Well, how it's going to play out remains to be seen. But Jim Reams has been off the job for more than 6 months now since he was suspended by the Attorney General. We waited until March last month to find out exactly what the complaints were against him, ranging from sexual harassment, gender discrimination, hostile work environment, you name it. But then we find out that, the Attorney General is not going to charge him criminally with anything, including apparently financial mismanagement of the budget and the forfeiture account there. So now, yes, Superior Court Judge McNamara called the suspension unlawful last week and ordered that Reams be reinstated, but he gave the state 30 days to appeal to the Supreme Court. And as you said yesterday, the Supreme Court said it's not going to delay his return while the state appeals that ruling. So conceivably, he could be back at work next month. We know he's said he's not going to seek re-election, so his term will expire at the end of the calendar year, and plenty of people have lined up down here to replace him. Looks like we'll have quite a big field in the Republican primary, but what a mess. What a mess.
Kevin, it's been a tough road for Jim Reams, but I'm interested. Do you think that if this goes his way in the end, there's going to be any repercussions for Joseph Foster? And there's been some criticism that he's overreached on this and trying to remove an elected official. Is any implication or danger for him at all in terms of his reputation as Attorney General?
I think there's a potential for that, Dean, and I think that is part of the motivation of Jim Reams. He said he's not running for re-election. He wants his reputation back, and I think he wants to sully the reputation of the Attorney General's office for overstepping their authority. As we heard in the opening, that's the core argument in court from Michael Ramsdell, his very able defense lawyer. And they feel no criminal charges here, may have a lot of conduct that's unbecoming, to be sure, but that the attorney general did not have the authority to remove him. That's their argument.
Norma?
Well, I think that Kevin's right. This is about reputation and you overstep. But I also think that there's been an awful lot of embarrassing things said about Jim Reams that is probably why he's not running for reelection. And I think that he wants back in and then he'll get out.
But we have not heard if he's actually going to go back to work. It's just simply that. Is that correct? He's just simply, Joanne, he hasn't announced whether he's going to return. It's just he has the option. Is that correct?
He certainly has been clear all along that, yes. He wants to go back to
then he may actually go back
the remainder of his term. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kevin, one other sort of high-profile case in the news this week. A high-ranking priest in the Catholic Diocese of Manchester was given jail time for financial misdeeds. Could you give us a little bit of the background on this case?
Yeah, wow. How the mighty have fallen here. Ed Arsenault, who was the chancellor of the Diocese of Manchester, who was really the right-hand man to the Bishop John McCormick at the time. John McCormick, you may recall, was sullied by the child abuse sex scandal in the Catholic Church and his involvement in it. Ed Arsenault became the moderating force, the person who was very popular among priests. I mean, in terms of, again, full disclosure here, he filled in as the parish priest at my church in Manchester when I lived there at St. Pius. Probably one of the most smartest and most charismatic clerics I've ever met in my life. But as we see, people have a private side, and this private side here was not pretty. He's been sentenced to 4 to 20 years in state prison.
Big fine, right?
Yeah, for restitution of $300,000 for stealing up to that amount from the Catholic Church, from the estate of a Monsignor, and from Catholic Medical Center. And it appears using much of that money to support
a personal relationship
with a gay pop star who sings gospel songs. It doesn't get any more sordid than that.
Pretty remarkable story. Well, coming up, we're going to take one more break, and then we'll take a look at a newly announced Republican candidate's first week on the campaign trail, and we'll find out how he did after a short break. So keep it right here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. The Supreme Court upholds a Michigan law banning affirmative action, and the FCC announces plans for new net neutrality rules. Then President Obama begins a four-nation trip to Asia, all coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from New England College, with a convenient site in downtown Concord offering master's programs in public policy, business, and mental health counseling, registering at nec.edu. And from Vineyard Brands, importers of La VFM wines, from Fami Perrin of the Southern Rhone Valley, available in New Hampshire State liquor stores, on the web at road.net. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Monday on The Exchange, the latest news in the field of autism. Join us by calling in at 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Twitter or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. It's the Friday News Roundup today, and my guest in studio, I have Kevin Landrigan, political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua, Norma Love, State House reporter for the Associated Press, and joining us by phone, Joanne McKenzie, New Hampshire editor for the Eagle Tribune and editor of the Derry News. Folks, let's take a look at some political news this week. We have a new Republican gubernatorial candidate, Walt Havenstein. And Mr. Havenstein was hit very hard by a Concord Monitor editorial, which had the headline, "A Dismal Start for Havenstein." Now, conservatives will say, well, no great surprise there, coming from a predictably left-leaning Concord Monitor. But Kevin Landrigan, how is Havenstein doing so far?
Yeah, he's a retired defense contractor, big campaign giver to Republican causes in the past as well. Someone who the elders of the party really look to try and recruit to run for this race. They like Andrew Hemingway, the other candidate. They feel he's too young and inexperienced to take on Governor Maggie Hassan. Havenstein had a pretty good announcement, but it's been a rocky road ever since. And certainly that abortion position he had was...
Could you tell our listeners a little bit about it?
Basically, first off, he went on WGIR radio and said, I don't really want to talk about that. That's not what I'm talking about. You don't get to run for governor and not have a position on abortion. That's the first mistake. And that's what we're seeing from this guy. I mean, very likable guy, has a nice way about him, but he's the first-time candidate for any office. They make rookie mistakes. That was one. He then goes on WMUR and says, I'm a pro-choice candidate with reasonable restrictions. Well, what the heck does that mean? What are reasonable restrictions to abortion? Here's the problem with abortion in politics is if you're in the median, you're roadkill, which is in an election, you have to be pro-choice or you have to be pro-life and you have to live with the consequences. Scott Brown doesn't talk about abortion. Here's why. He's a pro-choice Republican. It's going to be difficult for him to win this primary. He also knows my position on abortion helps me in the general election. Gene Shaheen has won every election. Back to the state Senate, running against a pro-life Republican. So Havenstein should say very little about abortion and not try and put him try and be in a position where he's trying to please both camps and both of them are angry at him.
Mr. Havenstein has kind of cut a sort of, you know, CEO-style candidacy. Former Republican Governor Craig Benson was at his announcement. Your sense of how this is going to play both in the Republican primary and hypothetically were he to get the nomination?
Well, I think honestly, he stands a pretty good chance in the primary because, as Kevin said, you know, a lot of people think Andrew Hemingway is just not ready for prime time yet. So that would serve Havenstein well. Yeah, there are shades of Craig Benson, and we know how that worked out for him. He opposes a lot of things. I'm still waiting, honestly, to hear some alternative solutions to those problems. He opposed the gas tax. He opposes expanded Medicaid. He wants smaller government. I think he has a lot of positions out there that we haven't heard about yet. I also think with Kevin saying, you know, you can't flip-flop on abortion, we can look to another New Hampshire Republican, Mitt Romney, how that worked out. But I do think he has to – I disagree. I don't think he can avoid it. I think he's got to establish his position and let everyone know what that is. So it could be an interesting race.
It seems that way. Norma, your reactions to Mr. Havenstein or the race more generally for governor?
Well, I think the thing that struck me was he said we have to stop the stagnation economically, but I don't know what that means, and I don't know that any governor has total control over the economy. The truth of the matter is that Craig Benson is the only governor in recent memory who has lost the confidence of the voters for a second term. This is Maggie Hassan's first term as governor. So far, she really hasn't done anything that just has raised the ire of voters that I know of to the point where they'd say, let's not give her another 2 years. So I think Havenstein's role is probably as much one of keeping her busy and not helping Terry Norelli win Democrats for the House or Sylvia Larson win Democrats for the Senate.
Kevin, there is this tradition of kind of the CEO candidate in Republican circles, and that's my sense from my initial contact with Mr. Havenstein of sort of how he's going to present himself. If we turn out to have a closer race than people seem to think in November between Governor Hassan and hypothetically Mr. Havenstein, how will the Democrats go after him?
Well, I think they're certainly going to go after his residency, as the Telegraph first reported. He lived in Maryland for a period of time. He had a condo. He had a driver's license for a period of time there. He benefited from two in-state tax breaks there. There's going to be a challenge to his ultimately to his eligibility as a candidate for the Ballot Law Commission. I think our domicile residency law is so weak. I think Walt Havenstein could, and he could, he should survive that challenge. But essentially, they're going to Norma's point, they're going to use the Benson model. They're going to essentially say a CEO, my way or the highway approach. We've seen that movie. It was chaotic. It was combative. It was there was a screaming headline almost every week when Governor Benson was governor. We, as political journalists, loved that period of time. I mean, there was all kinds of falderal going on. Craig Benson was vetoing a state budget approved by a Republican legislature. That's what they're going to say, which is it works in business. You get to make the decision, and all your employees get to nod happily in agreement. That's not how politics works. Right.
Government is just a different universe. Yeah, I think you're onto something there with their approach. We'll certainly watch this race as it continues to develop in the coming months, and I'm looking forward to the probably Republican debates late in the summer. Let's turn our attention now to kind of a surprising story. We all worry about identity theft these days. We all know people who have been victims of it. We have this surprising story this week that the U.S. Secret Service is investigating reports that I think it's up to almost 150 New Hampshire physicians and healthcare professionals have had their Social Security numbers stolen and fraudulent tax returns filed on their behalf. Norma, can you just give us a little general take on this issue? It's just something that's just been breaking over the last few days.
Well, they're trying to figure out how they got the Social Security numbers and whether they targeted physicians, because it's not really a big secret that this happens in our country. I mean, people have found that when they've gone to file their tax returns, the government says, but you already did. And privacy, identity theft is a big problem in this country, given all the digital information that's out there. A lot of places are saying, hey, we aren't going to use your Social Security for identification anymore. But I can remember years ago when my medical records were all identified by Social Security number. So the kind of information that they have hacked into from somewhere, I would suspect had to do with medical records, and that they have somehow filed or somehow someone has got a hold of, because it appears they think, well, doctors make a lot of money. We'll have good chance of getting a big return.
Yeah, and Joanne, we've had a number of these kind of identity fraud, credit card theft issues in recent months. I think Michael's, the craft store, was hacked, and Target. Seems to be becoming an increasingly large problem. I mean, what's your sense of sort of how this is this something that the state can deal with, or is this really an issue for the feds?
I think it's an issue for the feds, and I think it has, you know, I know this is getting a lot of attention because it is high-income doctors whose identity was stolen, but it happens to ordinary people, sadly, every single day. And I think it has consumers a lot more cautious about how they use, particularly debit cards. Maybe it's going to be a return to a cash society. I don't know what the state's role in this can be.
Yeah, and I do remember
issue.
I do remember those days when my parents did everything with cash. There were no credit cards. They had to pull out the cash, and maybe we are, in fact, headed that way. It's a very interesting story. I know that this is something that many people are concerned about, and I thought it was particularly fascinating. You know, you go to file your tax returns, and they say, well, you've already filed. It's a little bit of a shock, I think, and we're still learning about this case.
I think medical identity theft is particularly troubling because—
Sure, because of the privacy aspect.
Well, then you run the case problem of someone gets a hold of your records and you're shut out by HIPAA. Yeah. And how do you fix it? Or you go in you got the wrong diagnosis in your records.
Right. This is a whole issue of privacy and correcting the record. Well, we'll continue to watch that story. It seems to be developing almost on an hourly basis. I want to turn our attention to an interesting story out of Ware, New Hampshire. And Kevin, there's this report by the state attorney's general office looking into an officer-involved shooting down there about 8 months ago, dealing with a drug dealer fleeing the scene of a drug sting. And everybody's been waiting to see what the attorney general was going to say. And they basically said that the shooting could have been prevented, but there's not enough evidence to really decide whether or not the use of force was justified. Can you bring a little bit of clarity to this for us? It's a very kind of a confusing story.
It is a very confusing story. It happened on a late August night, 2013, in a Dunkin' Donuts parking lot where where police officers, as you said, were engaging in a sting against Alex Cora de Jesus, a suspected drug dealer. It got violent very quickly. He was shot by several officers and died. He did not have a weapon. I've been doing this job for 26 years, and I've never seen the Attorney General Office come out with a report that says an officer-involved shooting was a crime and the officer should be prosecuted. Maybe it's happened and I missed it. Now, this is the most critical report I've ever seen of an officer-involved shooting. Talk about damning me with faint praise. They say the Ware Police Department weren't properly trained. They say the supervision was not well done. By the way, the sergeant of that police department, who was one of the lead kind of commanders on the site, has been fired by the town. They say for different issues. It was extremely critical. They say that there was allegations and some suggestion that there was witness tampering after the fact, that some officers spoke with witnesses and tried to get them to change some of their stories to make them more favorable to the police. Again, no charges, but no ringing endorsement from this attorney general this time.
Yeah, and Joanne, you cover a number of different towns. We occasionally hear these stories. You know, these are small towns. They're short on resources. You have small police forces. Is this a common problem, or is this an unusual sort of situation?
I think it's unusual in exactly what Kevin said. The AG's report was far from an endorsement of the Ware police conduct that night. Called the sting itself ill-conceived, said he had grave concerns about the conduct of police. It happens more than you'd like to think in a place like New Hampshire. But again, with Kevin, I did a little digging. I can't find a case where the Attorney General's office has ruled that police were at fault in a shooting incident. So we've had several cases down here in the last few years, and in every case, the AG has said police were correct in their conduct, and given the reports, we don't have any reason to think otherwise. So I don't think we have these rogue police out there roaming the hills of the Granite State, but I do think this particular incident raises some serious concerns about that police department.
Norma, any thoughts?
Well, I think that what's going to happen is there's going to be a civil lawsuit, and there'll be a lot more come out during that case against the Ware, and I think Ware is probably going to end up having to pay some money, either through a settlement or through trial.
As a result of
action. Because right. When you have the Attorney General's report so strongly critical, even though it didn't take that last step, I think that the defense is going to bring that in and say, look, here's this, and this. And Ware is going to be having to think about whether they have a defense.
And so we're going to follow this. I think this is probably going to go on for some time with obviously lawsuits that are likely to follow. We're running out of time, but I want to end on, as we did last week, on a baseball story. Kevin Landrigan, the Fisher Cats announcer, has been called up to the big leagues. Tell us a little bit about this.
I love this story. Alex Miniak, who was the announcer for the Fisher Cats. I've been to a number of Fisher Cats games. He has a great voice. He beat out 800 people for this job at Petco Park. I want this job, okay? And here's why. Is to be in the booth and actually broadcasting the games, you're competing against guys like Jerry Remy, Jim Palmer, Hawk Harrelson, Curt Schilling, all icons, all popular players. You're never going to get this job. If you've got a wonderful voice, which I don't, but Alex does, you get this job. And what's great about this job is it's a wonderful day. That's your job, which is welcome to Petco Park. Right. Let's all stand to honor America with God Bless America.
Feel good job, for sure.
You know, now batting designated hitter, David Ortiz. And every time you're introducing that person, you introduce them as if they could hit a home run. Right. You're not the guy who's in the booth explaining why your starting pitcher can't get out of the third inning for the third time in a row.
And I think, you know, in the digital age where there's increasingly it's all about the big video screens, it is nice to have that carryover from an older time of baseball. Well, we're just about out of time here, so we'll just go around the table real quick here and over the phone. What are you folks going to be covering next week? And Norman, let me start with you.
Well, I'm assuming that gambling is going to be up in the House on Wednesday, and that will probably be the main show. This is the bill that would legalize two casinos versus one and distribute $25 million in revenue sharing aid to communities. I predict that it will probably fail.
Kev?
Yes. I'm going to be looking at this Medicaid enhancement tax. I don't think we're going to get any final solutions next week. There are not going to be any votes. But we're going to see what the patch for that flat tire I talked about looks like.
And Joanne, anything big that you're looking at next week?
We're going to be following up on the gas tax on a local level and what it's going to mean for our individual cities and towns down here who are going to get a little bump in their bank accounts.
Well, I would like to thank my guests. We are out of time. Kevin Landrigan, political reporter from the Nashville Telegraph. Kevin, it's always great to talk to you.
Great to be with you, Dean.
And Norma Love, senior state house reporter for the Associated Press. Norma, pleasure to talk with you as usual.
You too, Dean.
And Joanne, thanks for joining us over the phone. Joanne is Joanne McKenzie, New Hampshire editor for the Eagle Tribune and editor of the Derry News. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Thanks, Dean.
I'm sure we're going to be talking about all this stuff again next Friday, so we hope you'll come back. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm, and our intern is Katie Ortiz. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Dean Spiliotis, sitting in for Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, re-examining autism. As a new report shows, ever-rising numbers of kids with this disorder, while new research suggests autism starts in the womb. Then, allergy sufferers beware. After a polar vortex winter, predictions are for a pollen vortex this spring. And as more women choose to give birth at home, the state's medical community is taking note. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us all next week for The Exchange. Every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where we get support from you, our listeners. Support also comes to us from the University of New Hampshire's online Master of Social Work program, now accepting applications for August admission, mswonline.unh.edu. And Centrix Bank, see beyond with Centrix Bank, providing complete business banking services to small to medium-sized businesses in New Hampshire. Information at centrixbank.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. The Supreme Court upholds a Michigan law that bans affirmative action at public universities. Seven other states have enacted similar bans. The FCC proposes new rules that allow internet service providers to make deals with companies